welcome to the Inform Podcast. This is episode number 30, where the cat's meow of the podcasting world, Jared. Say hello, Jared.
Hi, Neil.
Jared and I are going to talk in an informal yet hopefully informative way about what topic this week?
We're going to be talking about entering into analysis.
All right. Very cool. So you and I, you know, kind of engaged in a little bit of a back and forth. I think it was after our last episode, which I want to point out was our interview with Todd McGowan, and has very quickly and unsurprisingly become the most popular episode of the Inform Podcast. Wanted to say thanks again to Todd McGowan if he's listening to this. And thanks to everybody who, you know, took the time to download and listen to that. So after we did that episode, you know, we did a short talk afterwards, and this emerged as an interesting topic for us because, you know, I've entered into an analysis. I believe you've entered into an analysis, and it's easy to take for granted, I suppose, that that's something which is somewhat difficult for people to do.
Yeah. No, there's definitely a truth to that for multiple reasons. I mean, there's the act of finding an analyst, like geographically, depending on where you live, that's more or less difficult. There's the decision to look for a therapist at all, and then like the sort of whittling it down into deciding on an analyst as opposed to some other kind of therapist. I mean, there's a whole lot of different choices. So it's a multi-directional difficulty.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, so maybe that's actually a good place to start out, right? So I would like to talk a bit about what it was like for me when I first tried to find an analyst, and how I went about finding one, and maybe also a little bit about how I ended up entering into analysis, because I think there might be something interesting in that. That sound good to you?
Yeah, for sure. We'll swap stories.
All right, perfect. So, you know, I started to read about psychoanalysis for many years before I entered into it. And I would say that for probably about 4 years, maybe even closer to five, somewhere between 4 and 5 years, I was reading a lot of different things. And as I was reading about psychoanalysis, I started with Freud, kind of bounced around, read a lot of object relational theorists, read some self-psychology, read some ego psychology. And as I was going through that, I happened upon Lacan. And when I happened upon Lacan, it was through Winnicott, because Winnicott was a guy who had been sent by the IPA, the International Psychoanalytic Association. He lived in London, and they sent him to Paris, where Lacan was doing the analysis the way that he was. And they said, hey, Winnicott, go check out what this dude's doing and tell us what you think. Is he up to no good? Is he doing analysis? Is he all right? Should so on and so forth, right? So Winnicott went and checked it out. And I remember as I was discovering this and reading about Lacan and talking to other people about Lacan, there was many different times where people told me, don't bother with Lacan because Lacan is impossible. He's unreadable. He's a charlatan, which is something that Chomsky called him at one point, right? He's this guy who knowingly and deliberately makes himself extremely obscure. He says that he's just not writing for idiots, but that's ridiculous. I was told to stay away, which had the inverse effect on me, right? It made me more curious about Lacan. Ultimately,
maybe that was their point.
Whether they realized that or not, that is kind of how it went. And so I started to learn about Lacan. And of course, Lacan did practice analysis in a way which was different than everybody else in Lacanians today. Practice analysis, I'd say, in a way which is very different from other analysts too. Mm-hmm. The most noticeable way is, of course, that Lacanians practice like a variable length session. The session is over when something happens, not necessarily when the clock strikes whatever. And that was kind of interesting. So anyways, I'd read a lot about this stuff, and I went about trying to find an analyst. And, you know, I live in the Chicagoland area. You live in the Chicagoland area. And there are three sorts of psychoanalytic institutes here. We have the Chicago Institute of Psychoanalysis. We have the Chicago Center for Psychoanalysis. And I'll group this in with them reluctantly. The C.G. Jung Institute is here as well. And so that means there's, you know, three training institutions. So there's people who are training to be analysts here. There are people who are analysts, but most of them tend to be situated like in the city of Chicago proper, right? They're there. And I do not live inside the city. And Chicago is, for anybody who doesn't live here, the idea of driving sometimes from outside of the city into the city might seem like it, okay, no big deal. Well, if you go at certain times a day, it's going to end up taking you like 90 minutes to get down there and then however long to find parking, right? So it's it can be a real significant ordeal to get into the city. And especially if you're going for a session, which might end up being like 20 minutes long, it becomes potentially problematic, right? So that was one of the things that I was looking at. I did find
question
some,
for you. I did, yeah, go sorry for to it. Interrupt, but I so you you say for a session that might have been 20 minutes long. I'm wondering if you think that at a Freudian institute it might have actually been 20 minutes.
Oh, for sure. I did. I'm glad that you say that. I didn't actually find any Lacanians in Chicago,
right?
So at all, but I think there are some now. But when I was looking, I couldn't find any, and I looked hard. But you're right. If I went to a standard Freudian-style psychoanalyst or an object relations or a self-psychological person, chances are I'd be having like a 50-minute session, I'd say, somewhere around there. But still, I mean, you're driving however many minutes in and however many minutes out, and it isn't like you're going a far distance. It's just the traffic is horrendous, you know. And I know that other cities like Los Angeles is like that. New York is clearly like that. They at least have a good public transportation system. And Chicago has a decent public transportation system in the city. The problem is getting into it. Anyways.
Getting there, yeah.
You know, so I'm willing to bet dollars to donuts that other people who live in other areas maybe have a similar sort of issue if you live like near a real big metro area or something like that. So anyways, I looked for an analyst. I actually went and I did some initial sessions with some analysts to see kind of how it went. And, you know, they were all right, but none of them really did it for me. Right. There was always like an issue that kind of got in the way. Sometimes their fee was more than I was willing to pay more than I was able to pay. Sometimes their demands were, you know, that you have to be here 3 times a week, so on and so forth. And again, now you're talking about 3 times a week driving and all this stuff. So anyways, I my attempt to find an analyst who could work with me were just a failure. They didn't work. I couldn't find one. I couldn't find one who would work with me. So anyways, eventually, and I was looking for a Lacanian anyways, I just couldn't find one. But I found a website for the Lacanian Compass. And on that website, there's a directory of members. And some of those members are analysts. Not all of them are. So I looked there and I found 2 analysts who were the closest to me. One was in Missouri and one was in Omaha. And I emailed them both and said, hey, I'm in Chicago. I'm trying to find a Lacanian analyst. Do you happen to know anybody who I could contact? And I heard back from the guy in Omaha. I did not hear back from the person in Missouri. And the guy in Omaha was like, I don't really know of anybody, but you know, what's your interest in Lacan? And we started to correspond through email. That led to a phone call where we talked, and the gentleman whose name is Tom Savolos, he invited me. He's like, if you want to try analysis, you should fly out to Omaha, where my office is, and we'll do as many sessions as we can in one day. And I was like, oh, that's interesting. So I did that. I flew out to Omaha. I met with Tom, and I think the first time I flew out there, we probably did 4, maybe 5, but at least 4 sessions that day. And so we'd do a session. You know, he'd say, okay, this is a good stopping point. I'd go and I'd read or I'd get lunch or coffee or something like that. Cause his office is in an area where there's plenty of stuff around. It's near the University of Omaha. Then I would walk back and we'd do another session, so on and so forth. And so I did that. And then at the end of that first session, he was like, well, do you want to do it again? And I said, yeah, we negotiated rates and fees and stuff like that. He's like, well, next month, if you want to do it again, we'll schedule it. So the next month I flew out again. I think I did that 4 times. So for 4 months, I would fly out to Omaha and I would meet with this guy and we would do as many sessions as we can in a day. And then after doing that, he said, you know, you clearly want to do this. This is something that you've flown out here 4 times, right? Like that's a big deal. And you're serious about it. So, you know, I think we should try to meet in person as much as we can. But when we can't meet in person, let's do sessions through the computer. You know, let's do internet-based sessions. And that's what I've been doing since then. I'm still in analysis and I'll do, you know, sessions throughout the week through video technology. We happen to use Skype for ours. And then I will, occasionally, you know, when we can kind of sync our schedules up in different ways, meet with Tom individually, and we'll do, you know, several sessions usually in a day when I do that. And that's kind of how I entered into analysis. So that's my story about it. You have anything that you want to say about your own story, or if there's any questions you have, I'd be happy to answer them.
I think it's really interesting. I know the directory that you're talking about on the Lacanian Compass website, and it's interesting that even now, aside from yourself, which is a relatively new addition, those two are still probably the closest people that are Lacanians to the Chicagoland area. At least, I mean, as far as I know, I'm sure that there are other Lacanians around Chicago, but they aren't part of this this larger group, which makes them, I would imagine, more difficult to find. I don't know. I think that's an interesting kind of shame. Like that's kind of a bummer, right? There are other large cities, and Chicago is, I don't think it's high up on the list of large cities, right? I almost said shitties.
That's a funny slip, dude.
That was a pretty good one. Yeah. Well, because what I was going to say is that despite being atop the list of large cities in the United States, it's probably one of the most difficult states to find a Lacanian analyst in. I mean, New York and California, it's relatively easier to find one. There's a much
too.
Higher
There's
concentration.
Huge
yeah.
Number
yeah.
Number of Lacanians in Miami.
Yeah, for sure. So I don't know. I think that's interesting, and that's one project that I know you are aiming to work towards. And I guess that does lead me to a question: is like to what extent is your difficulty finding an analyst near you in the Chicagoland area reflected in the desire to perform that project?
Which project? When you say that project?
Sorry, yeah, I should have been more specific. Becoming a member of the NLS, specifically in Chicago, trying to organize is the wrong word, but like talk to more psychoanalytically minded people around the Chicagoland area. I don't think it's remiss of me to say that you and I work on other projects outside of this as well that involve talking about Lacan, psychoanalysis, Jacques Lemoyne, and stuff like that.
Yeah, for sure. So I think I get the question that you're asking, so I'll attempt to
answer
it.
I'm probably asking it really poorly. So,
And if I don't answer it, just, you know, ask it again. So one of the things that I'm doing right now is I call myself a practicing analyst, right? This is something that I do that. Now, this is one of the things which is different. Sometimes when I say that to people, they might assume that I'm like somebody who went through like an IPA style institute, right? Like the Chicago Institute of Psychoanalysis. I didn't do any of that. My training is as a Lacanian analyst. And so what that means is that I've gone through my own analysis. I go and I have a Lacanian supervisor who I consult on cases with. I am a member of cartels, you know, which are essentially the word I guess like the closest parallel you have to it is a class, right? The New Lacanian School is this institution, which is part of something called the World Association of Psychoanalysis. And it doesn't have classes in the traditional sense. What happens is people get together and they form a very small group of five people. And that group of five people decides to do some really serious work together on something that they all tend to think, okay, yeah, we'd all benefit from this. So I do that sort of stuff, so on and so forth. I'm active in the Lacanian world. The Lacanian world is kind of like Fight Club. You determine your own level of involvement. You know, there isn't the rule that you can't talk about the Lacanian club. You can. You just have to determine your own level of involvement. So I think that was like the second rule of Fight Club, if I'm not mistaken. Or the third. Yeah, I think it was the third. I'm going down a weird cul-de-sac. Anyways, yeah, so I do that. And you were asking, you know, about my difficulty, I think, finding an analyst. And did that difficulty finding an analyst motivate me to be a practicing analyst here in the Chicagoland area? And if it also has motivated some of my other activities that I'm doing to try to pull other people in?
Yeah.
I mean, the short answer is absolutely, right? It was really hard. And I believe that Lacanian psychoanalysis is a really wonderful way to have a certain kind of experience, which I believe has a very positive effect. It had a very positive effect on my life. It continues to have a positive effect on my life. So I would like it very much if that were available to people. Of course, I don't want to impose it on anybody and say like somebody must get analysis or they must get analysis with me, but I would like it to be available. The other stuff that I'm doing now, you know, is of course trying to find people like you and other like-minded individuals who want to get together and start to create a, you know, a committed group of people who are interested in psychoanalysis more broadly and Lacanian psychoanalysis somewhat specifically, so that we can start to talk about how we can take the innovations of the praxis of Lacanian psychoanalysis and make use of them in our clinical practices, right? And I'm trying to, hey, if anybody's interested in talking about that, let's talk, ultimately, is the way that I'm looking at it. And if you go to the Lacanian Compass website now, you'll see that there's like, there, you know, New York has a really solid group. Miami has a really solid group. Houston, actually, uh-huh. is a very solid group of people doing work. And I'm trying to establish something along those lines here in Chicago. And it's not like you have to be a part of that group. You just, you kind of got to, I guess, express interest and then have the available time to meet up with us when we're doing our things. Like right now, our group is doing a real deep read through of an article by Jacqueline Miller, The Turin Theory of the Subject of the School. And when we're done with that, we'll move on to something else, you know, but that's kind of how it's going at the moment. I don't know. Does that actually answer your question or did I like range too far?
No, it answered my question and then some more to put it one way. Yeah, no, it makes sense. It was maybe a question that you had already answered in your story, but I still think it was important to ask. Like delineating stuff like that, I find totally fascinating. And another reason that I was interested in asking that question is because you and I live in the same general area, and I experienced a similar difficulty where I had to fly out to meet my analyst. We see the same analyst, so I had to fly out to Omaha to meet him, and it was hard, but it was worthwhile, you know. Another part of the difficulty that I experienced that maybe you can relate to, maybe you can't. I'm not sure. I got cold feet the first time that I tried to do it. I set up a day with him and all that good stuff, and then I sort of chickened out on it the first time. I'm still not sure why. I've never talked to him about it ever. I'm not sure why yet. I don't know why I haven't done that yet. At some point it'll come up and we'll get to talk about it. But the very first time I set it up and then I didn't go. And then it wasn't for like, I don't know, 4 more months before I tried again and actually put in the time and effort to make it happen. And now we've been seeing each other for a while. So
that's interesting.
I had a similar difficulty.
Huh. You know, I think that's really interesting because I hear that a lot. I hear that people will reach out to an analyst and they'll say like, hey, I'm curious. What's the process here to kind of come see you or whatever? And you email, maybe you talk on the phone or whatever. And yeah, people will be like, I'll think about it. And then, or maybe they'll even go so far as to kind of like set up an initial thing. But then as that date draws closer, it's not uncommon, I think, that people will be like, oh, now is not a good time mm-hmm. for various reasons. And they back out of it. So it does happen a lot. It happens to me anyways, as people like reach out to me for analysis. It doesn't happen every single case, of course, but it happens with at a regular interval. Uh-huh. What do you think that is? Why do people do that?
My first instinct is to say that it's a little bit individual. For me, it was a financial matter. My wife had recently changed jobs and we have a very small child. So like when I first reached out to Tom to talk about it, I thought I was in a good position. And then it turns out that I wasn't in nearly as good of a position as I thought I was. So maybe now as I talk about it, I'm working out what happened, but I'm also loath to say that that's the only reason because there are probably ways that I could have made it work. So my first instinct is to say that maybe it's individual, but then I'm reluctant to say that that's the only determining factor.
That's interesting too, because I mean, with our topic today about, you know, entering into analysis, I would imagine that, I mean, some people, this might not be the case, but I think for a lot of people it is. Trying to explain to your partner, if you have a partner, your family, your friends, your colleagues, you know, if you need to, that you're going to do this thing called psychoanalysis, and you kind of explain the format it's going to, like in our case, right? You're going to fly to a different state to do as many sessions a day as you can. And so, I mean, you're paying for the analysis in a variety of ways, right? You're paying in the airfare that you use to get out there, the time. And then of course you're paying the analyst whatever fee you arrange, which I think is something we'll talk about later. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, that's, I mean, you pay a lot. And I think if you try to explain that to people, they will be like, why are you doing that? You know, or they'll say something like, well, why don't you just see like a normal therapist, whatever,
right?
You know, like, can't you just do that? Wouldn't that be easier? Like, you could use your insurance. Psychoanalysts don't take insurance. So on and so forth, right? Like, I mean, speaking for myself, there have been times I know where, like, you know, I've talked with my partner about this. You know, psychoanalysis is a thing that you pay for, right? And it costs whatever it costs, and that's a thing. So for me, it's something I feel really deeply committed to, and I'm very fortunate that my partner, I think, understands the nature, the why that is so important to me. We've been together for a long time, so I think she gets it, and she's very supportive. But not everybody will be in that position, right? Not everybody's partner either will be supportive, or maybe they would like to be, but they just, it's really hard because of things like finances or, you know, you and I both happen to have small kids and stuff. Like, when I started in my analysis, I did not have a child. It's been going on for years. And, so in my life then versus my life now, it's not the same thing, right? It's having a child makes your life radically different, you know, and stuff. So yeah, I mean, all these things are things that people do need to consider when they go into an analysis. And to your earlier point, I think that, you know, kind of setting up shop here in the ways that I have are kind of like my attempts to try to make it somewhat easier for people to be able to access an analyst.
I think it's a worthwhile and fun project that I'm excited to watch expand. It's funny because I think, funny is the wrong word, but it's the one that came to mind. I think that psychoanalysis has a lot of things to offer because it doesn't require billing insurance. I mean, I'm not sure that it could offer the same things if it did have to bill for insurance. And it offers something to people who might otherwise not be able to afford to see a therapist at all. Like, am I making sense? I don't know if I am.
You are in your, yes, yeah, basically. But it is interesting though too, because like, on one hand, you know, since if you're billing insurance, you're billing, you know, an amount that you've contractually agreed to when you become in network with that insurance panel and those sorts of things. And when you're not, you have freedom. You can set your fee wherever you want to set it.
Right.
Now, I say that, and I say that with hesitation, because one of the things that has happened in my practice, right? Like, I'm a social worker, and I want to make psychoanalysis available to people. And there are some patients that I see now, and they pay me, an incredibly low amount of money for the work that we do. And I'm like, right now, it would be very difficult for me to continue to offer that to people. And there have been times where people have come to me, and they've basically told me that they have some very real limitations financially and whatnot in their lives, and they would really like to do analysis. And at this moment, like when I'm talking into this microphone today, I don't think I could take somebody else on if they're paying me a really low amount of money and then be able to, you know, afford the things that I need to do. Like, I have an office. I, you know what I mean? Like, I have expenses that, and I can't, I do need to not lose money in doing analysis, right? I can't have it be a thing that by providing people analysis, it ends up costing me. I need to be able to, at the very, 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 very least, break even, and also make some money too, ultimately, right? So that I can see to my own financial well-being and stuff like that. So it's interesting that you bring that up, because the fee is such an interesting component of analysis. I think that would actually be a really interesting thing to do an episode just on that, right? Just on the fee and the way that the fee can be used as an intervention the role that it plays, et cetera, et cetera. So I'll kind of just kind of, you know, put a pin in that for the time being. But your point is that, yes, you can set the fee wherever you want to. You can see people multiple times a week. You can see them multiple times a day, as I did with the analysts that I work with. And these are things that you wouldn't be able to do if you were billing through insurance. So yeah, when you take the insurance companies out of the equation, it certainly does open up a whole world of possibilities.
Yeah, that's kind of the point that I was getting at, that it feels like it has a... The psychoanalysis feels like it has a dimension that's left out of other kinds of practices. And maybe that's unfair of me, given that I'm more familiar with psychoanalysis than I am with other forms of therapy. I mean, I'm familiar with several of them, but I'm the most familiar with psychoanalysis. So maybe it's an unfair coloration for me to put on it. But at least that's the way that it looks from the position that I'm in right now.
Yeah, that makes sense. Totally.
Sure.
So we had some other questions I think that we wanted to get to. I think we're just sort of like meandering around here.
Yeah, I think you're right. So you have a note here that I'm really curious about, because I know nothing about it, about moving from the waiting room. And I know absolutely nothing about this concept. I shouldn't say that. I know it's from a Jacques-Alain Miller piece. But sure. Aside from that, I know nothing.
Yeah, okay.
So kind of guide me through it.
So there's this idea that, okay, this is hard to talk about, but I'm going to do my best here. And I want to talk about sort of two different setups. So setup number one, one of the things that I do is I people will kind of like look me up, because I am in network with a couple of insurance panels right now, and I do provide like in psychotherapy, and I bill insurance for it. It's one of the things that I do. I don't always do that. So sometimes people will show up for psychotherapy, not necessarily for psychoanalysis, right? And they'll come in with sort of an idea about how it's going to proceed and so on and so forth. And then what might happen is that person might want to move from psychotherapy into doing psychoanalysis. Something might happen that makes that an interesting thing. They want to try it for whatever. So in that sense, I think of being like kind of like being in psychotherapy. It's sort of like being in the waiting room that you might, and then from there you might move into psychoanalysis. And not everybody does that, of course, but some people do. However, there's other times where people show up and they say, I want psychoanalysis. Like, and when people show up saying they want psychoanalysis, they've done reading about psychoanalysis. Like, I've never, and I don't know anybody else who's ever had like just some random person who like gets in contact with them and says like, hey, you're a psychoanalyst. I'm curious about psychoanalysis. I don't know anything about it. You know, can I give it a try? Like I've never, maybe that has happened to somebody else. I just don't know anybody who it has happened to. Right. Usually people show up and they know something about psychoanalysis. They've read about it. They've been exposed to it in university or something like that. And they're seeking it out that way. When I went to my first session in psychoanalysis, one of the things that came up is, so like, why are you looking for psychoanalysis? And I said, 'cause I want to be an analyst. And Tom, the analyst, was just like, that's a really funny reason. That's what he said to me at the time. I was like, what do you mean it's a funny reason? It's like, why? Why is it funny? And he's just like, he didn't answer my question. As time progressed, one of the things that became clear is that I wasn't there to become I actually ended up talking about things that had nothing to do with me becoming an analyst, or had very little to do maybe with me becoming an analyst. I talked about the things that made me anxious. I talked about the things that pissed me off. Mm-hmm. I talked about dreams that I had. I talked about the trajectory that my life was on and how I felt about that trajectory. And as a result of talking about all these things, which were not like how I want to become an analyst, things came up. And as a result of those things coming up, I gained a deeper understanding of what I think of as my fundamental fantasy, of my symptom, et cetera, et cetera. And that's a much better reason to go to analysis, you know, than to say, I just want to do this thing so that I can become an analyst. Because again, one of the things that kind of is, I'd say a kind of hallmark of the Lacanian world is that you don't become an analyst by going through a certain number of sessions for a certain number of years, a certain number of times per week or whatever. That's the way that each individual analyst forms is 100% unique to that analyst. It is their process and it will not ever be recreated. There'll be some similarities between one person's formation and another, of course, but even there's a point at which the similarities cease and difference is there, right? And your formation and my formation will be different, and my formation and somebody else's formation will be different, so on and so forth, right? And that's the reason that you go. But to your question, I think I was in the waiting room when I was saying I'm here to become an analyst. I'm going through this process to become an analyst. That's when I was in the waiting room. Here's the as I understand it, and this is taking something which is fairly complex, and I think I'm going to try to kind of condense it into something that we can talk about. When somebody shows up for an analysis, a lot of times I think they are in the position of making a demand of the analyst. Fix me, cure me, make me understand this thing, help my, save my relationship, make my spouse understand a thing, make me stop drinking. Who knows? It could be any kind of demand. Or in my case, the demand was, give me this experience so that I can be an analyst, right? Like that, I was, give me a thing. I'm making a demand. When you're making a demand, you are in the waiting room. Mm-hmm. However, at a certain point, I think people will cease making a demand of their analyst. And what will happen, and it happens whenever it happens, there's no way to predict when or how it will happen. A person moves from making a demand to asking a question. Why do I do that? How did I get here? If this keeps on happening in the same way multiple times, why is it that I repeat it again? What am I trying to get out of this? These are questions that people could ask. And of course, there are so many more. When people start asking those questions, that to me indicates that the patient has been hystericized in a way, right? They've moved into the discourse, a different thing, right? They're starting to ask questions. They're starting to consider different things. And I think that that's when you can say that a person has entered analysis, when they start doing those sorts of things. Now, maybe people kind of go back and forth for a while. They go from waiting room to analysis, maybe back to the waiting room for a bit. But there's going to be a point, I think, where somebody actually kind of like gets deep enough into analysis, and then they're kind of there. They're in it now. They're doing analysis. And what happens in that instance when somebody crosses over from the waiting room to analysis is that the patient or the analysand starts doing the interpretation, right? They're not looking to the analyst and saying, interpret. They go to analysis, to a session, things are said, things happen. And then as a result of those things that are said and the things that happen, the person leaves the office. And as they leave, they're thinking about their session and they have all these questions now. And they're going, why am I doing this? What am I really after? And that's them interpreting themselves. There's Juan Felipe Arango is a guy who I know in the Lacanian world. And at one point he called it, you turn on the paranoid machinery of interpretation for the patient, right? And that, for me, is one of the things that I use as an indication that maybe we've kind of gone from the waiting room into analysis. Now, you mentioned that Jacqueline Meller does this. I read about this term, the waiting room. And I believe I read about it in an issue of the Lacanian Review, the 7th issue, which is titled Get Real. You can find it on Amazon. I'll put a link to it in the show notes today. And he has some diagrams that attempt to like illustrate this process in there. I think the article starts on page 65. I looked at it before our conversation today, but I don't remember how many pages it is. And it's entitled Exist, or EX-IST. Is the title of the article for anybody who happens to be interested.
That was a lot, but I really like it. I especially like this, like specifically the metaphor of the waiting room. So like I'm picturing, you talk about being in the waiting room as making a demand, and then you shift from the demand to the question or the desire. So I'm picturing someone in a waiting room who is like, I don't know, tapping their foot, or like they've got their arms crossed and they're, like watching the clock, or they're reading a book. Like those are all in this metaphor, those are all demands, like open the door and come see me. Like I've been waiting here. I'm sitting here tapping my foot, like notice that and come take some action so that I can go into your office and start the session. And so then the flip side of that is someone who's sitting in the waiting room and, well, no, not somebody who's sitting in the waiting room. Sorry. I'm thinking this through as I'm saying it. So it might not make as much sense as I might like, but then you shift when, in this metaphor, when you stop tapping your foot and anxiously waiting for somebody to open the door, like as you walk into the room. Does that make any sense? I'm speaking on this ridiculous metaphorical level, and it's just because I like this metaphor so much that I want to keep drawing it out.
Yeah, I mean, and that's one of the cool things that I think also about the Lacanian world, right, is that these are ideas. They're not rules. They're not standards.
Right.
Okay. So, which we've talked about on previous episodes, and I'm sure I'll talk about on future episodes. But what happens here, I'm tended to point out one thing. So one is that the patient, the analysand, does pass through the what's called the discourse of the hysteric.
Mm-hmm.
So the discourse of the hysteric is where the person is making a demand. The hysteric makes a demand. The hysteric
right.
believes in this instance that the analyst is the master.
Mm-hmm.
And they say to the master, do
bestow
something.
Bestow upon me. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. They that's the demand. Well then, so the analysand, the patient is trying to enact that discourse. The analyst on the other side is not doing that. They're not accepting that casting. They will not be the master. They will not mm-hmm. meet the demand. And so they slide into the discourse of the analyst. And if anybody wants to know more about these discourses, there are four of them. You can Google that, the Lacan, the four discourses, you'll find stuff. And if you want to do like a deeper reading, read Seminar 17, The Other Side of Psychoanalysis, which is translated into English. I think you can find free PDF versions of it online. But yeah, there's a really good Russell Gregg translation, which you can get from Amazon. And I'd recommend that translation above all others because I think it's the best. But anyways, that's what the analyst does. They go into this other role. So what is the discourse of the analyst? The discourse of the analyst is where you just kind of slide out of reach in a sense, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the patient comes and they say, I have a question. They ask their question. They demand an answer. And instead of giving them an answer, you do something where you say like, that's an interesting question, right? Which isn't answering them. And they'll be like, yeah, I know it's an interesting question. That's why I asked it or something like that, right? Like they'll have their response to that. And you just kind of go, huh? Yeah. Right. And so like you're engaging the person, but what you're not doing is gratifying the demand.
Right.
And no, this is the thing that, which is interesting too. Like I don't recommend necessarily going right into that right off the bat. That's the thing. Cause there are some people for whom this would be a not great way to engage them. If you're mm-hmm. dealing with somebody who's a triggered psychotic, for example, I don't know if the discourse of the analyst is such a great idea. I would argue that
right.
it isn't, you know? You have to make sure that you have to do various things to make sure that it's okay to do this.
Mm-hmm.
And that it takes time to figure that out. Right. So and that's interesting. What I think is fascinating about this is the transition, right? Where the person in the beginning believes that the analyst or the therapist has the skill, the knowledge, the capacity to provide them with something. That's what they're going in there with. And that's what's empowering the discourse that they're attempting to enact, where the analyst is kind of playing the part of Socrates, right? And people went to Socrates all the time and made demands. Hey, Socrates, you're so smart. Make me smart. Tell me how to be wise. Tell me what you know. And Socrates responded in an analytic way by saying a version of, the only thing that I know is that I don't know things.
Mm-hmm.
And then people were like, what? You know, and They'd walk away from their conversation with Socrates and they'd be like, what even just happened there? What he started the thing and how do you, and you know what I mean? They're somewhat off kilter.
Right.
And when they're not like, you know, so off kilter that they're in crisis, but they're not thinking their normal way. They've been knocked askew. And that's an actually productive thing. Now this is, of course, I think very contrary to many forms of psychotherapy, which I think are only aimed at stabilization and at making people, I'm using my fingers for air quotes here, into well-adjusted people,
mm-hmm.
right? Like a Lacanian psychoanalysis does not seek to do that. It doesn't seek to prevent it, but it doesn't seek to do that, right? Instead, it's just kind of like, what happens if we sort of engage with this person in a way that makes them go, what's going on? And they leave the session not with everything tied up with a bow on it, but kind of with a mess that they need to clean up.
Right. That makes sense. Tell me if this metaphor, this way of thinking about it makes any sense to you. So if you think of someone acting the master as holding something in your hand, I don't know what it is, but you hold it in your hand so that the patient can't see it. And then they ask for you to give it to them. So you hold out your hand, you open it and give it to them. Whereas if you're acting the analyst, you don't hold anything in your hand. It looks like you are, but you're not. There's nothing in your hand. They ask you to give it to them and you open up your hand and there's nothing in it. Does that make any sense to you?
Maybe. That's interesting. I never would have thought of it that way. Huh. I'm curious though. Like my initial reaction is no. That's not what it's like.
Okay.
But maybe it is. I'm not sure. So again, my initial reaction was I'm not trying to hide anything in my hand, right?
Yeah, that's certainly where it falls apart. It's that's like certainly just one hole that it has.
Yeah. It's more like the person is like, hey, you have a secret, right? Like, I want to know the secret. Tell me the secret. And the analyst response is, it's interesting that you think I have a secret, right? It's like that. Like, what made you think that? And the person's like, well, you're an analyst, clearly. You didn't just like, you know, I hope you didn't just like, you know, do this the way that people like, you know, are able to marry people. They applied for something online and now you're like, you can marry people, right? Is that how you become a psychoanalyst? It'd be like, so you must know things. And that's actually one of the things that's important about the analyst discourse. So in all four of the four discourses, there's something called the truth, and the truth is a repressed truth. It's part of the discourse. And in the analyst discourse, the analyst does in fact know things. The analyst does, you know, have probably an understanding of psychological theory and symptom formation and interventions that can be used, all blah, blah, blah. Stuff is there. But they're not necessarily using it, I suppose, right? It's there. And part of it is also, I think that, yeah, I don't know. That's the best way I can describe it, because I think S2, yeah, is the repressed truth in the analyst discourse.
That makes sense. I certainly see the hole in the metaphor that I tried to give, but I do think maybe that it has something to it. So then maybe to clean it up, if you're acting the analyst, your hands are like already open. Like, look, this is all that there is. There's nothing hiding inside of them. I'm not covering over anything. What I have to offer is right here. Like, you can plainly see it. It's not being hidden by me at all. I'm not trying to deceive you into something. This is what it is. It's all on the table already.
Yeah, I think that's a fair way to put it. It would make sense to me. So hold on one
second.
Yeah, I just had to check something here to make sure I was right about S2 being the repressed truth, and I am. It's one of the things that happens is that we're talking about transference here, right? So like there's a certain kind of transference in the beginning of an analysis,
right?
Well, the person's in the waiting room, they have a certain kind of transference. I think that maybe that transference changes as a person enters into analysis. Okay. And the transference in the beginning is the transference of you are the one who knows, help me know too. To wait a minute, what do you like? Maybe you actually don't know, right? So what ends up happening in an effect of an analysis is that you, as an analysand, you are put to work. What are you put to work on? You're put to work on interpreting your own stuff, right? So it seems to me that many times people, even people who are, you know, somewhat well read in psychoanalysis, assume that an analyst is going to be doing a lot of interpreting. And they think that's what they'll get when they go. And, you know, sometimes, I mean, as an analyst, I do interpret. There are times where that happens, but that isn't the only thing that I do. And the idea here is that there's a different form of intervention you can deploy, which you and I have talked about in other conversations that we've had just amongst the two of us. One word for it is equivocation. And when you equivocate as opposed to interpret, one of the effects of that is that it takes the analysand and instead of presenting them with here's what it means, it makes them go, I want to work out what that means. Mm-hmm. I want to work it out. I don't want you to work it out. I want to figure it out. And that's different, right? And if that happens, what's so interesting about it, right, is that the person, the analysand, has become somewhat more responsible, right? They're responsible to interpret some of their own stuff, to understand themselves more. They're not outsourcing that responsibility to the analyst or to the analytic process. They're going, that's my thing. I need to do that. Uh-huh. You know, and I think when they're in that mode, you could say that analysis is occurring. They are interpreting themselves. They're analyzing themselves.
Right. No, that's really good. I like that way of thinking about it. It also reminds me of something else that I thought about while you were talking through the waiting room. It reminds me of something I've been told in my own analysis, which is that when you come to a session, you have to choose what you're going to talk about. So like when I finish a session, something that happens to me almost every time now, it didn't used to happen. It used to happen a lot differently for me, but something that happens almost every time now is that the session will end. It ends on something, some event or other will happen. And that's where my analyst will choose to stop it. And then 100,000 different things will come to mind before our next session. And you have to pick which one of those is the one that you're going to talk about. Even if you go to multiple sessions, like at each of my sessions, there's only a finite number of things that I can choose to talk about. And you have to make a decision. And it's hard. At least for me, it felt really difficult to make those decisions. In fact, when I first started going to analysis, that was a huge obstacle that I had to get over. Like I would pick one thing, like in advance of the session, like a week before the next session, I would already know this is the thing that I was going to talk about. And it took a long time for me to really get over that. Even now, sometimes I have to resist it a little bit. But my point is that when a session ends, I think you want to be in the latter position where what's been said can be taken an infinite number of ways. You want to be in the position of having to pick from a lot of things rather than already knowing, quote unquote, knowing what you're going to talk about during your next session.
What's also interesting about that is that you, when you pick something, you've also censored all the other things.
Yeah.
Right. And I mean, that in and of itself, I would imagine has a level of significance, right? Are you keeping in choosing to talk about X? Is that because you are afraid of what would happen if you talked about Y?
Right.
You know, and I'm sure that's the case some of the time for everybody. Probably not the case every single time for everybody, but often that's the thing. When you say that, I know that, I mean, yeah, you're totally right. Like I've gone into an analysis and I've worked out ahead of time what I think I'm going to talk about. And what'll happen inevitably now, and I just sort of like am used to it, I think at this point, is I'll talk about the thing that I've decided I will talk about for a little bit. And something else comes to mind, right? Uh-huh. You know, and I didn't necessarily expect that it would. And so then I start talking about this other thing, or the analyst will say something which will call up a different thing. And then I'll, you know, but it is you one of the things that is a principle of psychoanalysis is the principle of free association. You know, uh-huh. Speak as openly as you're able to. Try your best not to like censor yourself or make everything make too much sense. Don't worry about it if it doesn't. And of course, I mean, everybody worries about it, and we can't speak totally openly. It's impossible.
Right.
But the idea is that you, I guess, make an effort and
you try.
Yeah. The analyst, of course, has judgments. When I listen to people, I judge them, you know, but I do my best to listen from a place of non-judgmentalness and all those sorts of things. It's an interesting process. I don't know. I wanted to point out a different thing that kind of came to mind in this conversation. We didn't talk about this beforehand, and maybe it'll have legs. Maybe you'll think it's interesting, or maybe you'll be like, that's stupid. We'll see. But I think in the beginning of an analysis, one of the things that's going on is that the analysand, the patient, believes that they owe the analyst for their interpretive capacity, right? I'll owe you for that. And then as time goes on, one of the things that I think could happen is that the patient realizes that they owe the analyst money for the session, you know, or whatever, but their interpretation, they don't owe the interpretation anything.
What do you mean by owe?
Good question. Okay, so I think sometimes people like go to like a psychotherapist, right? They'll do the same thing that they do with an analyst where they show up with a demand, like tell me how to be better or whatever. And then let's just say for hypothetically speaking, sake of the example here, say a therapist gives somebody advice. Okay. I think that a lot of times the patient might feel like they owe the therapist and the way that they will pay what they are owed is by taking the advice to heart.
I see. Okay.
Following it. They feel that, right? So in the beginning, the analyst, of course, like maybe eventually slides in this discourse of the analyst. And part of the effect of that is on the patient is that the patient starts to go like, oh, wait a minute. Like I don't have to listen to this person. I don't owe them anything. Right.
Right.
They say things. I say things. They say things. Things happen. And that's it. You know, it's not like the analyst said, if the analyst offers an interpretation, and I think an interpretation kind of like sutures things together. Okay. You could believe it's correct or believe it's not. Believe it's partially correct. If they offer an equivocation, you know, it's hard. You go, what do I do with that? Like, I think that people are expecting that the analyst is going to, if they behave like most therapists, or is this going to like task them with something and they're going to feel obligated, like they owe the therapist, and to follow through on whatever. When a person passes into an analysis and they're not being tasked and they're not being advised, they're not being told how to live or what to do, they don't know, right? There's no expectation that they will, you know, follow the advice or do the task because it's not there.
Right. No, that absolutely rings true. I've certainly experienced that myself where so what you're saying is that at first, anyway, when you first enter into an analysis, you feel like you have to accept the interpretation that's given to you by an analyst. And as you move through it, you can change your stance on it. And you don't have to buy anybody's interpretation of your behavior, your thoughts, your speech or whatever. You can push back on it. And part of the transition is recognizing that your analyst isn't going to like drop you isn't going to stop seeing you because you disagree with the interpretation that they've given you. They're not going to refuse to see you or tell you like you're an idiot for not buying into my interpretation. That's not going to be on the table at all. And in fact, I would probably argue that the opposite is going to be on the table. Like, please keep pushing back. Tell me why I'm wrong because I want this to be your work.
Right. Totally. You're hitting on something here, which I think maybe you and I know, but I don't know that people who are listening to this are going to necessarily know this. We're getting at some of the differences between Lacanian psychoanalysis versus other schools of psychoanalysis as well.
Yeah.
So like in other schools of psychoanalysis, I think that what will happen a lot of times is an analyst will offer certain kind of formulaic interpretations, like that's an ego defense mechanism. You know, it's doing this, or that's your Oedipus complex asserting itself in certain ways, right? So that's what they do. And those interpretations are in effect like could be read, you know, and they're read by me as the analyst saying, "Here's why you're doing what you're doing. Let me explain it to you. Let's create a explanation for something that baffles you." And there are people who find that to be genuinely helpful. Okay. So, and they will, hopefully they'll find an analyst who will do that, I guess, and whatever will happen. Lacanian analysis, on the other hand, tends to avoid that sort of interpretive work, right? Uh-huh. And what a Lacanian does instead is much more of that equivocating, I think, where it's trying to create an experience or the conditions within which the analyst hand will start to interpret their own stuff. Mm-hmm. So if you give them an interpretation, this is my argument. If you give somebody an interpretation, they're probably not going to interpret their stuff because now they have an interpretation that they can either like go like, okay, that's it. That makes sense. I'll buy that. Or they'll rebel against it. But either way, you've provided them that. That's the analyst actually being in the role of the master, right?
Right.
Where in Lacanian analysis, the analyst is in the role of Socrates again, right? And Socrates, whenever somebody comes up with like a, hey, give me an interpretation, tell me something concrete, Socrates doesn't respond with something concrete. He continues the discourse and he gets the person to start, instead of posing their questions to Socrates, they're posing the questions and they start to realize that the person they're asking is themselves, right? Mm-hmm. And that Socrates keeps on kind of doing a version of like, yeah, what do you think? And so then they're like, yeah, what do I think? And they start to engage in that process, which is a different thing. I mean, this is part of some of the big, you know, kind of like bad blood, the beef between Lacanian analysts and the more, the other schools of psychoanalysis, right? Mm-hmm. Is what it comes down to. So those other schools, a lot of times are seen as being a little bit too free and loose with, explanations for the patient.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you, I want to get this on record. I want to make sure that, if people are going to have beef with Lacanians, that it's on record. Why? In this way, at least, do you think that Lacan might have been more Freudian than Freud? Because one of Freud's assertions was that you should never make an interpretation until it's on the tip of the tongue of the patient. So I'm wondering, do you buy that? Do you buy that in this way, at least, that Lacan might have been more Freudian than Freud?
Well, it depends on which
Freud. You're on record.
It depends on which Freud we're talking about.
Okay, that's fair.
I think there are multiple Freuds, right? So there's Freud as he's like working with Breuer and kind of like doing the demo tape that is psychoanalysis of in studies of in hysteria. And then you have like the early stuff, right? Where he's really working out, I think, like the unconscious. I mean, this is the interpretation of dreams, the psychopathology of everyday life, those sorts of things. And I mean, for my perspective, my opinion is that Freud's like bar none, like greatest hit of all time is Beyond the Pleasure Principle, right? That's where he introduces the death drive, which I think mm-hmm. is the thing for, right. That's actually kind of a psychoanalytic pun. But it's,
that was good.
Yeah. You know, it's, and then, you know, after that we have the ego and the id, and then we start to enter into this like period where he moves away from the topological model towards a structural model, id, ego, superego, so on and so forth. And then, I mean, you know, Freud keeps on changing is what it comes down to. He was people say that Freud discovered the unconscious, and whether people think that's fair or not, he's the guy who articulated it,
mm-hmm.
you know? And when he was saying things that other people previously hadn't said, I mean, he was thinking, he was working things out. Freud's a fascinating person to me. I know some Lacanians who are kind of bored with Freud. I'm just not one of them. I think that Freud is extremely interesting. I read his case studies, Ratman, Wolfman, Dora, Little Hans. And I'm just into them. Yeah. You know, mm-hmm. I think that Freud was very brave because he was very open about his failures. You know, mm-hmm. and he was also open about the fact that, you know, I'm figuring this out sort of, and I'm making it work. Or at least that's one way you can read him. I mean, there's also the fact that Freud was extremely cruel to some people, like, you know, Sandor Ferenczi and Carl Abraham and other people who mm-hmm. were his friends at one point. And then like, he felt betrayed by them and then like, you know, kind of did this like scorched earth thing and all that. So, all of this is not answering your question though. And, it just depends which Freud, you know, we're talking about here. I mean, I think that what Lacan does is he takes what Freud did, and keep in mind that Freud, you know, was doing his clinical work during the Victorian era, right? Mm-hmm. Which was a certain time in the history of the human species, and that Lacan was doing his clinical work kind of like, you know, in the 19, late 20s, maybe 30s is when he gets going. But I mean, he really does hit the brunt of his work in the time preceding World War II, when the world was a very different place, right? And so one of the things that I think for me has been one of the things that I talk with other people about in the Lacanian world is this idea of what is the clinic, right? And we don't operate the clinic the way that Freud operated his clinic. We don't operate the clinic the way that Lacan operated his what's called his first clinic, right? This thing that is the clinic where we do our work, and the way that we do our work within it is fundamentally altered. Right now, today, I'm doing video sessions with patients. That's not something people could have done before, fairly recently. Now we can. You know, now some people would say, is that psychoanalysis if you're doing a video session, or is it not psychoanalysis? And, you know, I think that that's actually a really interesting discussion to have, but I come down on the side of like, well, it depends. It might be psychoanalysis and it might not be. It depends on if we're being loyal to the principles of psychoanalysis.
Uh-huh.
But the idea that to do psychoanalysis, there's a standard or a rule that you actually are always physically in the office with the analyst, then that's a standard. That's a rule, you know, ultimately. So I don't know if that actually even answers your question about Freud there, but that's my response.
It's a great way of keeping the peace between the Lacanians and the non-Lacanians in the psychoanalytic world. Good job. No, I think you're right. Freud was a guy who, whose thought, I mean, his career was long, and his thought developed a lot, and it changed over time. And he wasn't someone who pretended as if his thought hadn't changed. He didn't try to, at least when I read him, I don't see him saying like, I've always thought this, and anybody who says otherwise is reading me wrong. Like, I think he was someone who was ready and willing to admit that, like, what I was thinking was wrong, and now I'm going to change the way that I was thinking about this thing.
Yeah, I think that's fair, right? I don't know. It's wild to think about it. Like, I mean, there's some people who were in treatment with Freud, and they kept some records of what that treatment was like. And it's fascinating to read some of those too, because one of the things that I think I can pull out of that is that Freud kind of like prescribed a certain style of doing clinical work, but he didn't do it. He worked in a totally different way. I think Lacan, on the other hand, actually kind of prescribed a way of doing clinical work, and I think he did it.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's fair. And, you know, both probably served their purpose in a different way, but both served the purpose of what they were trying to do, right? I think Lacan enjoyed being provocative. He enjoyed,
without a doubt.
Yeah, I don't think there's much question about that. And so the kind of stuff that you and I have been talking about on this episode, like the short session, the different ways of conceiving, or the variable length session, excuse me, and the different ways of conceiving what happens in the clinic are like the reflections of the fact that he liked being provocative. He liked provoking people to think more, to think differently, to critically consider what they were doing when they were doing psychoanalysis.
And that's one of the things that happens, again, to kind of return to our topic today, I guess, that we were loosely using to orient ourselves.
Yeah, please return us there.
The entering into analysis. When somebody enters into analysis, the analyst kind of like, I think it can affect that role, right? They're being, okay, so it's like when I keep on referencing Socrates, part of what I think makes Socrates what he is that he's kind of a clown, right?
Mm.
You know, he was a bum, literally. We don't know that Socrates actually existed, but if Plato's accounts are to be believed, Socrates was kind of like a homeless guy, you know, sort of like couch surfing in Athens. And everybody was like, oh, this guy's just, we don't know what he's going to say. We don't know what he's going to do, but we know that when he says it, it's going to be good. Right. And so that was the thing. And then and inevitably Socrates, like, you know, people became his enemies because of a whole bunch of things that would take a long time to go into, but people did. And I think you see a lot of parallels between Socrates and Lacan. But when somebody enters into an analysis, a Lacanian analysis, eventually what happens is, yeah, you can kind of like adopt this role where what you're doing is you're kind of being like, you know, I maybe I do know things. Maybe I don't know things. You don't know. I don't know. You know, you can be kind of like provocative in that way. But the question is, what are you provoking? Right. And I think that what you're provoking is the paranoid machinery of interpretation. You're turning that on. You're provoking that in the patient, in the analysand, and getting them to do that.
That's good. That's good stuff.
All right.
So what I'm going to take away from this is to be more like Socrates.
Sure. Yeah. Find your way of doing that. Find your way of being more like Socrates. So anyways, we had a whole bunch of other notes here, but maybe we'll save these maybe for different days because there's some interesting thoughts here that we didn't get a chance to touch on. But I think that might be a good ending point. But before we end, I'm going to ask you to talk about something quickly. Okay?
Okay.
You have your own podcast that you're doing now, which is your project. And I was wondering if you would mind talking about that project, telling people where they can find it, those sorts of things. Like, talk about the podcast that Jared does that is not this podcast.
Sure. I began a podcast. It's called Disentangled. There's a little slash there between the dis and the entangled. It was a project that I've been thinking of for quite a long time, actually. I got the idea from you in one of your classes, actually in more than one class. But either way, you do this thing where you write on the board. It's three lines that all intersect with one another. So you draw one that like directly intersects that one, and then one that goes in between the two lines that are already intersecting. And each of these three lines represents a sort of different like area of thought that you find interesting, and that defines like the place where you work. That's what the what makes it click for you, if that makes sense. If I'm characterizing you unfairly, then please correct me. But that's the way that I took it. Maybe that's not the way that you intended it, but that's the way that I took it when you and I talked about it during your classes.
I think the only way I would describe it a little bit to give people a visual. So imagine like a horizontal line from left to right, then imagine a vertical line from top to bottom, and of course they create an intersection, and then imagine a diagonal line, say from like lower left to upper right, that also intersects those two. So you have essentially all the lines coming together at one point. And that one point is the point where I say that I kind of like describe what those lines are for me. And I say, this is sort of where I'm doing my thinking and my working.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I stole that from you and turned it into the idea for a podcast. So the project that I'm working on is having other people come on to talk about what that intersection looks like for them. So, you know, I've had someone on that you've been on their podcast. His name is Adam. He runs the Red Library podcast. He talked about political theory. He talked about sociology and psychoanalysis. And that was sort of the crossroads, meeting point as the way that he sees it. I had on a couple other social workers that are also from Texas, where Adam is located. And then I recently had you on as well. I haven't yet published that episode of my podcast, but I will be soon, and I'll be cross posting it to both the Disentangled feed and to the Inform feed. And the last thing I'll say is that if you're interested in that project, you can find it on most places where you find podcasts. Like, it's on Spotify, it's on Apple, it's on Google, and all that type of stuff, just by searching for Disentangled. And I'm sure we can put a link to it in the notes as well.
Yeah, for sure. So that's awesome. Cool. When you started doing that, I thought that was really interesting. And I think that the work that you're doing is cool. So I just wanted to make sure that the people who listen to this show know that that's out there, so that they can listen to that if they want to. I think that'd be really
cool. I'll say one last thing. I know I already said that I was going to say one more thing, but I'll say one other thing besides that, which is that if you're someone who listens to this podcast and you're interested in being on it, please reach out to me, and I will be glad to have you on the show. That would be so much fun. We'll include a link to the email that I used to receive messages about that show as well.
Sounds good. All right. Do you have anything else that we wanted to talk about here today, or do you feel like we've more or less, not exhausted, but said what we need to say about the topic?
I think we've said what we need to say, Neil. And, well, you know what? I'll revise that. There's more to say, but I think there's enough left to say that we can save it.
That sounds good. It's funny because, like, since we had Todd on last week, and they usually end, you know, their podcast with "What's the lesson?" And I was thinking about that for this one. I'm like, is the lesson to be Socrates?
I don't know. Maybe, or maybe the way that you put it when I said that is better, to find your own version of being Socrates. I don't know.
All right,
I guess we'll find out.
Yep. All right, Jared, you take care.
Bye, Neil.